Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Okay, my next guest is an author, but also a public intellectual on the world stage, addressing big ideas and big issues about the state of the world. Naomi Wolf, you're very welcome. Sorry, Naomi Klein, right? Klein? Not Wolf, right. Naomi Klein. And Naomi, I know you'll forgive my little joke because you do get confused with the woman you call Other Naomi, and it is the kicking off point for your new book, Doppelganger. So Naomi Klein, you're very welcome.
Well, thank you for that. It used to be that presenters would mistakenly call me Naomi Campbell, and that was even worse because I just came as such a terrible disappointment. You know, they're expecting this luminous supermodel and out comes me, so.
And look, not that people wouldn't see why you'd be confused with Naomi Campbell, but you can see why you were confused down the years with Naomi Wolf. I suppose you both written big idea books that kind of defined their time. She wrote The Beauty Myth. You wrote No Logo, The Shock Doctrine. Would you kind of have occupied a similar box in people's heads a bit, the two Naomis?
Well, clearly, because it did happen periodically. And, I think there's sort of something about the name Naomi where it's like it's just uncommon enough maybe that the first Naomi that you come across gets stuck in your mind. But it used to be really nothing but a periodic, vaguely annoying happenstance where I would just say, gently say, keep your Naomi straight. I didn't write that book. I didn't say that thing. But it did become a little more serious during the COVID era when she really fell down the conspiracy rabbit hole. And I really did not want to be confused with what she was doing because I saw it as dangerous.
Yeah. So just to give people the picture who mightn't be overly familiar, so before she goes down the rabbit hole, she was reasonably well regarded, kind of seen as kind of liberal enough. The Beauty Myth was regarded as an important feminist book at the time and all that.
Yeah, I was an undergraduate when that book came out and it really marked a new era for feminism because it came out at the beginning of the 90s. So the 80s had been a period when, feminism, it's not that it didn't exist, but it really wasn't getting a mainstream platform. And then suddenly there was a new wave, a third wave of feminism, and Wolf was really its most recognizable face. And then she, she was a high-profile figure. She worked for the Democratic Party. She was Al Gore's consultant when he ran for president, advising him on how to reach women voters. She was on television all the time. So, her values were legible. She believed in democracy. She believed in human rights and women's rights. And then things started to get very weird. And she's not the only one.
We all know somebody in the last few years. So what happened to her and how did it happen specifically?
Yeah, and to be clear, I really just use my confusion with her, the way people confuse me with her, as a jumping off point trying to understand this broader confusion and this broader way that people have changed. The uncle, the brother, the yoga teacher who suddenly is talking about QAnon. And during COVID, she became one of the most influential vectors for medical misinformation, in particular related to women's wellness, fertility. She was one of the people who was most vocal about the claim that vaccinated people shed particles onto unvaccinated people and that interfered with their fertility, potentially caused bleeding, cramping, things like that. There was a study done by NPR in the States, the national broadcaster, that tried to get to, why did so many people seem to believe this untrue things about vaccines? And they did a data analysis and found that much of it could be traced back to a few posts by Naomi Wolf, or if you weren't reading too closely, Naomi Klein.
Okay. And was it the pandemic did it, or had she been heading in this direction?
I think that what I argue in the book is that she had dabbled in conspiracy before, and I think people here in Ireland might remember a notorious tweet about 5G and Belfast, which got some attention here. Do you know the one I'm referring to? Which seemed to suggest, as she visited Belfast and said that that it didn't, you know, didn't have 5G, and it recalled the sort of calmness of the 1970s, which, as you can imagine, led to a sort of mock, you know, a Twitter pile-on of the likes we'd rarely seen, or that we see actually quite often.
Yeah.
So yes, she'd been dabbling, but with COVID, something different happened. There also had been a moment, I think, is probably important to understand the trajectory. Right before COVID, where she had published a book called Outrages, which was about persecution of homosexuals in the 1800s. And she had made a really big series of factual errors that were revealed live on BBC. It turned out she had misread the historical record and believed that that about 12 people had been executed when, in fact, they had not been. And so that moment was like every writer's worst nightmare. And it went viral, and there was a pile-on. And so I think she entered the pandemic in a very destabilized state.
Okay.
And a lot of people were in a similar state because their businesses were closing. You know, their understanding of themselves in the world was shut down because they couldn't be public figures. So I think a lot of public figures lost their marbles during COVID and found ways to get other kinds of attention.
Okay, so then, and this is where, and the book isn't about Naomi Wolf really, it is, she exemplifies this thing. So she then becomes embroiled with Steve Bannon. People will remember Steve Bannon was a Trump strategist, but now kind of the spiritual leader, commander-in-chief of the MAGA kind of far-right crowd.
Transnational. I mean, this is an important piece, is that Bannon, once he, you know, he was actually pushed out of Trump's White House because Trump was threatened by the fact that people kept referring to him as his brain, right? And Trump didn't like people believing that somebody was pulling his strings. So Bannon gets pushed out. And then what Bannon does as a free agent is weave together this international network of far-right parties. So he's very connected with Bolsonaro, with Giorgio Meloni in Italy. And so he's not just a U.S. figure. And in the book, I use Wolf as my kind of like the white rabbit in Alice in Wonderland to lead me down the rabbit hole to the world of this far-right network. And I end up being, you know, more interested in some of the other people I meet down there, including Bannon himself. She starts appearing on his show regularly, sometimes every single day. He has a podcast called War Room. And she and Bannon put out a book together. And this is very weird if you think about who she was not so long ago. The idea that, you know, the first time she went on Steve Bannon's podcast, she said, "I used to think you were the devil." But she has decided, she's decided to make an alliance with him.
And her usefulness to him is fascinating, mm-hmm. that it's about the moms. Explain to me about the moms as a constituency.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think what she gets out of him is pretty straightforward, a massive platform, you know, new readers, new subscribers. What he gets out of her is what he calls MAGA plus. You know, he's a political strategist, and his skill as a political strategist, and he is very skillful, is to look at the issues that his opponents that his opponents have sort of left unattended, the disaffected. He did that in 2016 with union workers who had voted for the Democrats many times, and those politicians had promised to do something about these corporate free trade deals that had deindustrialized large parts of the United States and never did, signed new ones. And so, you know, I think it was really Bannon who coached Trump to make it a central part of his MAGA message to appeal to those working class men by promising to renegotiate trade deals. Now, Bannon is focused on their wives, the women, you know, in a lot of these far right parties, it's the men, but not the women who have crossed over.
Okay.
And Wolf to Bannon represents the promise of a portion of traditionally Democrat voting women, or liberal women who were upset about lockdowns, upset about mask mandates, upset about, vaccine mandates, upset about, you know, their businesses being closed. And he then very quickly pivots that to what he calls border warfare. He's very focused on, he has an extremely xenophobic anti-migrant agenda, but also everything is cast as an attack on the child. I think it's really, really important in terms of understanding right. this new politics. And it's very alive here in Ireland as well, as you know. I think you saw it just about a week ago outside the Dáil, where it seems very incoherent, but at the center of a lot of it is this sort of this image of the pure Christian family, the child who is being sort of invaded by these various forces. And that might be a vaccine, it might be migrants, it might be a telling of history that is threatening to national mythologies. It's very nostalgic for a kind of a bygone era. It's very patriarchal. People had their roles, and that makes it particularly ironic that Wolf, as a Jewish feminist, is playing such a central role in this.
You touched there on what I think is one of the really important things that you've kind of illustrated in this book. I thought it was one of the key lessons. You say we need to pay attention to the likes of Bannon because he is watching us. And the issues we are abandoning, the debates we aren't having, the people we are insulting and discarding, Bannon is around hoovering up those people. And they are, you point out, people... As you were saying there about the Trump voters, people who are traditionally served by the left, not being served by the left anymore.
Yeah, so I'll give you an example. The issue that was responsible for Wolf's star turn on the right was she put out a video several months into the pandemic, shortly after the vaccines were introduced, and it was focused on the vaccine verification apps that we all downloaded onto
vaccine passport, as they were called.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes they were called vaccine passports, and they hadn't yet come to the States, but they had come to Israel. They had come to the UK, and she puts out this video that says vaccine passports equals slavery forever. And it's a completely over-the-top video where she claims, against all evidence, that these vaccine verification apps will be able the government will be able to track who you're with, where you go, and also what you talk about. So she said, if you go to a restaurant and you're planning something political, they will be able to hear you. And then she says that this is part of a plan to bring a Chinese-style social credit system to the West. And it's going to give them so much power that they'll be able to turn off your life. And even it will have nothing to do with whether you're vaccinated or not. And so a lot of people laughed about this, in liberal left circles. How absurd. Of course, these QR codes can't listen to our conversations. It's not a social credit system. It's just a yes, no, have you been vaccinated? But there were legitimate questions to be asked about this increased digitization of life. What happens when you need a smartphone to access a restaurant? How does that discriminate against people who don't have smartphones? But many of those debates were just shut down during COVID. You were either kind of on board or you were okay. with the crazies. And there was this joke that circulated on sort of liberal Twitter, which was wait till they hear about cell phones. yeah. Which is funny. And I laughed the first time I heard it and I felt a little smug because, of course, I know that my cell phone can track me and listen to me. And then I just sort of stopped and thought, well, this is a bit odd because I'm not actually okay with any of my cell phone being able to do that. And there's this adopting of this kind of knowing kind of blasé attitude about issues that I don't think we should be blasé about. And that creates a perfect context for a figure like Bannon to say, come on over and we'll pretend that all of our surveillance fears can be projected onto this one app. And then we have a very quick fix, which is let's just get rid of the apps and then everything will be fine. And so that's an example of what I mean when I write that that conspiracy culture often gets the facts wrong, but the facts wrong, but the feelings right. And the feeling is this feeling that we are living in a surveillance culture. And a lot of us are not okay with that. But that feeling isn't being given voice or outlet in mainstream politics. So it's pushing a lot of people into what I call the mirror world.
So Naomi, the thing is, a lot of people are going to say, well, it is liberals and young progressives who are poo-pooing a lot of these people and not allowing maybe conversations to happen, that we now live in a world where if you say something that I disagree with, we don't have a conversation about it. You are just the most terrible person in the world and you need to be silenced.
Well, you know, I think, you know, what one of the issues that I explore in the book is how these social media platforms kind of program us to respond to disagreement and conflict by just by turning people off, by muting them, by blocking them. And then I think that that idea of just block, mute also translates into the real world. And, you know, one of the most interesting things for me since the book has been out, and it's been out for about 3 weeks now, is I've had so many conversations with people who did sever relationships with family members, with friends during COVID. It was a time of many, many severed relationships because we were all scared. And so if somebody didn't get vaccinated or somebody wasn't masking, they stopped being invited to family gatherings. Things got apocalyptic very quickly, right?
Should you have the unvax for Christmas was the big question at one point. Yeah.
And so I think what we're realizing is there's a consequence to the to those severings. Like sometimes people respond to being severed just by turning inwards and becoming lonely and depressed. Sometimes they find a new world, they find a new community, and then very quickly become radicalized and suddenly they have some really nefarious views where they're told, well, you have a stronger body, you have a stronger immune system. And those people who are getting vaccinated, well, that's just because they're weaker. And, you know, I started to hear really supremacist ideas in this world, like, well, maybe they should die. Well, maybe this is nature just culling the weak. And that's when you really get into fascist thought.
Which brings us to some of the kind of unlikely coalitions that formed around this as well. Like the yoga crowd, the kind of wellness crowd. Explain to me about how they fit into the picture.
Yeah, and I think it's not the whole yoga crowd.
Yes.
But I think there is a way in which, you know, one of the things that I explore in the book is the way, you know, part of the feelings that are being tapped into here is a feeling of profound insecurity and fear. Our economy is increasingly precarious. We're not offered jobs that are going to give us any kind of security for our lifetimes or pensions. So people respond to that often by focusing on the self, by creating a kind of a doppelganger of themselves, of ourselves, which is our personal brand, which may be our optimized body. And this is a lot of what gets sold in the wellness world, in the commercial wellness world of yeah, life is scary, but you can make yourself strong. It's a kind of a body prepperism in the face of the uncertainties and shocks to come. And so there is a way in which that kind of, I call it corporate wellness, because it, you know, there are wonderful parts of the wellness world, and I think. And I don't mean to say like anybody who cares about health and exercise is a conspiracy theorist, but there is a way that once you have already decided that your primary sphere of influence is your own body, and the idea that if you can just optimize yourself to be optimally fit, to count every step, that there's a way that it can easily slide into a sense of, well, my body is strong, my immune system is strong, and those people who we're supposed to get vaccinated for are weaker, and maybe, and you know, this is where you start to hear these ideas, well, maybe they should die, maybe this is nature doing its work. And there is a sinister history on the fascist right of a wellness holism coalition. Because ultimately, that is what fascism does, is it ranks a relative value of human life and says this in-group of good bodies, of strong bodies, of supreme bodies, has more of a right to life than these other bodies. I think it's at the heart of everything that is dangerous in our culture right now. So I think it's possible to bring some people back, and I think it is important to not just sort of tar everyone with the same, paint everyone with the same brush. But there are logics at work that I think are helpful to identify. And it's why you know, during the January 6th storming of the Capitol, you had the QAnon shaman, if you remember, you know, so you had some sort of recognizable figures, Confederate flags, neo-Nazis, Proud Boys, but then you also would have somebody who will lead you on an ayahuasca retreat, and and okay. you know,
yeah. Like I saw you tweeting about Russell Brand a week or two back, and he is a prime example, really, isn't he, of where this kind of wellness spirituality thing meets conspiracy theories.
Yeah, I think Brand, well, he is one of many figures who is more than an influencer. I think is marketing himself very much as a guru for people who want tips on how to live. And brings together these ideas around holism, wellness, spiritual uplift, with this very, very conspiratorial worldview that casts all power as conspiracy, and every institution as part of an elite conspiracy to hold you back. And it's very weird because these movements talk, often cast themselves as the only true Irish or the only true Canadians, very patriotic, right? You'll see lots of flags and you'll see lots of sort of national pride, but they're the same people who are most likely to challenge the results of a fair election, to storm the Capitol, to bring their gallows, which are not very democratic things to do. And in the States, it's tipped right into book banning. They're using the kind of the trappings and slogans of democracy and free speech and then using it against itself.
Okay. There's one other constituency that I'm fascinated by. You're a mother of an autistic child, but you talk about warrior autism moms and about how the anti-vax playbook in the pandemic actually kind of based on a similar movement in the autism world.
Yeah, so the through line of the book is the double. Not my own doppelganger, but the various ways we confront our doubles and create our doubles. So we've talked about the brand as double, the self as double that we create in the digital ether, the body as double, the idea that we can create this optimized version of ourselves and that will be our kind of life raft in these roiling seas. But there is another kind of double that I think is very much at work, and that is the child as double, the way sometimes parents overinvest in the perfect child, in part because they are so concerned about whether their child will be able to succeed in this extreme world where people can't afford rent and can't afford to move out of the house. So there's so much pressure being placed on children. And sometimes when these parents who are looking to the child to kind of be a double of themselves, a little mini-me, a little brand extension, and of course in the influencer space, you see this a lot on TikTok, on Instagram, that if you have a child who doesn't conform to societal norms of success, because your child is neurodivergent, because your child is different in some way, then often that can lead to a sort of a derangement where you're looking for cures and someone to blame. And so I don't write about my own child. I think that that's his decision whether or not he decides one day to share his own inner life with the world. I don't think I have a right as his mother to do that for him. But I did decide to write about my experiences in the autism parent community because I have been exposed to people who are just have this bloody-minded focus on finding somebody to blame for the fact that they don't have the type of child that they think they should have had.
Yeah.
And many people have tried to convince me to be part of lawsuits against vaccine companies. And there's this idea, and this is a part of the book that has a little bit of Irish content about the myth of the changeling, right? Where this idea that your child was sort of stolen by the fairy realm in the night and replaced with this alter child who is not really your child. And then it becomes acceptable to do all of these things to your child in order to bring back your real child. So the reason I write about it is because I think kids get abused by parents sometimes who, it's a terrible message to send to a kid that there's something wrong with them. I think autism is a different way of being human, and that we should we should fight for our kids to have full access to the public sphere, to have the supports they need to thrive in their schools, but not, you know, fight against the autism itself. And that's what this warrior mom identity, the autism warrior mom, is. They're at war with autism. And I'm not at war with autism. I will fight alongside my child for against the barriers that stand in his way.
Yeah, but you won't fix him.
No, he's not broken.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, I probably shouldn't have left this till the end. Time is kind of against us.
But I guess there's just one point that I didn't make. One thing, which is that a lot of the people who've been most vocal in the anti-COVID vaccine world cut their teeth in the anti-vaccine world, propagating this myth that there's a connection between childhood vaccines and autism, which of course there isn't.
Which has been absolutely disproven. So look, the picture you paint then, and we'll finish on this, is that we basically know in a world where people don't even agree on what reality is anymore, which is a very grim place to be. Can you give me in 1 minute an answer to how we start unraveling that? Is it about having the conversations that Steve Bannon is having?
Steve Bannon, Giorgia Meloni are doing a kind of mix and match of real legitimate concerns and a pivot to turning on some of the most vulnerable people in our society. So I think the main thing we can do is take the legitimate concerns back and try to have real answers to those legitimate concerns, whether it's anger at big pharma or big tech. I think there's lots of ways that we need to protect our kids and speak to those fears. But ultimately, I think the reason why conspiracy culture is spreading in the way that it is because people are trying to make sense of the fact that they feel betrayed by the system that told them that if they worked hard and played by the rules, they would be able to get ahead. So I think there are some systemic fixes that we need. We're not going to fix this one uncle at a time, I'm afraid.
Okay, yeah. And the funny thing is, when you say that at the end there about suspicion of big business, big pharma and everything, this was your stuff before Wolf came along. This was what you did. The book is fascinating. It's called Doppelganger, A Trip into the Mirror World. It's published by Alan Lane. It's in shops now. Naomi Klein, thank you so much.
What a pleasure to speak. Thank you so much.
Email brendan@rte.ie.